So this afternoon, I want to talk about dopant disorder, and probably it would be best if you just stop me and ask questions as we go along. If we run out of time, So this work is done in collaboration with Ujiga Sensei and good friend and colleague Hiroshi Osaki, Don Mali, and then members of my group in Cornell. I want to talk about searching for the source and the mechanism of the nanoscale disorder in the IPC cuprate, DISCO-2312. First, I thought that I would tell you some experimental facts of life, and these are facts which are rarely revealed in public, or mentioned or discussed. But probably for theorists to bring their critical powers to bear, there are some other things you do need to know about how these experiments work. So you have a little block of material. This is MACOR, got a very low differential thermal conduction. And in this block, there's an object which can be moved up and down in steps of about 500 angstroms. And it's very deterministic. This whole object, which is, you can just barely see it here, is moved up and down in 500 angstrom steps. And the STM tip is here. And the surface you want to study is pointing down here. Now, one thing I'd like you to remember is that no matter how complicated this object is, there is a lowest vibrational frequency for the tip vibrating relative to the surface. There's an infinite number of high frequencies, but there's one lowest frequency. That's our design criteria. When you bring the tip near the surface, if you have the density of states versus energy in the tip, density of states versus energy in the sample, when they're in tunnel contact, the two Fermi energies equalize, and no tunneling occurs. When you turn on this battery and you raise the Fermi level of the tip relative to the sample, then these states here become available for tunneling in a Fermi-Golden rule approximation. The tunnel current would be the integral of the density of states in the sample up to an energy controlled by the bias, by the battery producing the bias voltage. So this is the integral of the density of states in the sample. But now it's a tip, so the magnitude of the current goes exponentially with distance. As you pull the tip back, the current falls exponentially. So this is the WKB term, and this is your scale factor for the exponential decay. It's about 1 angstrom if the work function is in the 4-volt range. Now here's topographic imaging. If you go out to the store and buy an STM, a good STM will cost you about $250,000. When you turn it on, you can take these images. And they're very nice images. This is diamond diselenide, disco, and this is the oxychloride. You can see where the atoms in the surface are with subatomic resolution. Now what you're actually doing, though, of course, you're not taking a photograph. What you're doing is the tunnel current from the tip is related to a constant, and this has to do with the matrix elements of the surface, the WKB factor, and the integrated density of states. You tell your equipment to keep the current constant, and to keep the bias voltage constant, and to make all other necessary adjustments to keep those two numbers constant as you move the tip around. So the only adjustable parameter is the distance of the tip from the surface at different locations. And you see, this distance could be quite different if you chose a different bias voltage. So the idea of this as an image of where the atoms are is not correct. It's some kind of a contour which keeps the current constant for a given voltage. So here it is again, the current, WKB factor, the integrated density of states. Now if you take the derivative of this guy with respect to voltage, you find, because this is the integral of the density of states, at a given location, these are just constants. So the IDV is the local density of states. You do that experimentally by dithering the bias voltage, sine omega t times V naught. And that dithers the Fermi level of the tip. And that produces an oscillating current whose magnitude is VI. And we detect that with a current atom.
And that doesn't affect the WKB.
It does, but the amount you dither it is in the picometer range. Picometer range, effectively, it would be, if you wanted to do it mechanically, you'd be moving the picometers. Or to put it another way, if experiments are done where this dither voltage is too high in amplitude, you don't get the density of states. Anyway, so you could measure this DIDV as a function of V. And you get a function whose shape is the local density of states at that location. Well, here's an image of, topographic image of this globe. And here is the, in the superconducting phase at 4.2 Kelvin, and here is the differential conductor as a function of bias voltage, which is supposed to be the density of state as a function of energy. Let's say at one point. Now you want to take this spectrum at every point, sequentially. And you can construct a function, which is the differential conductance as a function of location at a given energy. And you can have it at all the energies where you make the measurement. So here's the differential conductance at this energy. As the energy changes, the image changes. Much of the electronic disorder in disco is associated with energies down here in your 40 millivolts. Now you see it. That's the nanoscale disorder. It's mostly associated with these energies. Okay. Now each of these spectra is about 200 independent measurements. You set the bias to a number and you measure the differential conductance. Then change by 2 millivolts and measure the differential conductance again, and so on. So it's a 200-point spectrum, and we'd like to have each point have a precision of 1%. That's a design objective. Now, if suppose it takes 10 seconds to get this whole spectrum, then if you take a 512 squared image, that's 2.5 by 10 to the 5 by 10, is 2.5 by 10 to the 6. It takes a month to get that data set. And when we started out 5 years ago, it took a month to get each data set. Even though for each conductance measurement, you were still just spending 50 milliseconds. Now, if you want to get away from this limit, a good target would be, let's say, 0.4 seconds per spectrum. That would allow you to take the data set in a day. That would make the technique much more productive. But then you only get 2 milliseconds for each conductance measurement with 1%. Now, how would you do that? Here's the current as a function of distance and bias voltage. And if I take the derivative of this, I get G, that's the differential conductance. Now, let's suppose that the tip is jiggling around. So here's my tip. Here's its support assembly. It's connected to some rigid frame. And here's my sample. And this guy, let's suppose that this guy is jiggling around by an amount delta z. You can look at this equation, you'll see immediately because of the exponential that the error in I, delta I over I, would be linear in the error, the first order, linear in delta z over z. And that's also true for the conductance. How much ever the tip is fluctuating, relative to this scale factor is the error in the conductor. And the scale factor is 1 inch. Now what this means is the following. You want the error in G to be 1%, 10 to the minus 2. But you've got to take your measurement in 2 milliseconds. That means your bandwidth has to be a kilohertz. So if you were dealing with white noise, you would require the spectral fluctuation in G to be 3 times by 10 to the minus 4 for root hertz. If you multiply here by the square root of 1,000, that would give you 30 times 3 by 10 to the 4, which is 10 to the minus 2. That would give you your power. So your design objective is to have your noise for delta G over G to be 3 by 10 to the minus 4 per root hertz in the bandwidth where you make the measure.
So how do you get the bandwidth again?
At kilohertz.
Why?
Because you have only 2 milliseconds to take the data. If you make the bandwidth narrower, you can't acquire the data in enough time. You can make it wider, but then you just get more noise. So you optimize the bandwidth for this objective. Okay, so here's our objective. Now, we know that delta G over G is linear in delta Z over Z naught. So delta Z over Z naught has to be 3 by 10 to the minus 4 for root hertz. And z naught is 1 angstrom, so delta z has to be 3 by 10 to the minus 14 meters per root hertz or below. That's why spectroscopic STM is different than regular STM. You have to be 3 or 4 orders of magnitude quieter for it to work. Now, if you make a model for how much acceleration noise in the laboratory. Let's make a model of this object as a spring and a mass on an infinitely rigid frame. And we're interested in variations of this distance. So the response of this guy, the displacement, will be two accelerations of this whole platform. Would be A over omega naught squared. As a function of frequency, at low frequencies it's flat, and then there's a resonance here. We do all our work down below kilohertz. So this is a force, it's kx is mass by acceleration, and k over m is omega naught squared. So the displacement is linear in the acceleration, and it falls quadratic in the frequency of the upper end.
The chemistry built a gravity wave.
So here is what happens to a white acceleration noise for a given frequency of your apparatus. You want this number, you can see it here, you want this number to be 3 by 10 to the minus 14. What that means is that the acceleration noise, let's suppose that the fundamental frequency is 600 hertz, so omega naught is 3 by 10 to the 3 radians per second. This number squared is 10 to the 7. Multiply up by 10 to the 7, we'll find out that the acceleration noise has to be 3 by 10 to the minus 7 meters per second squared per root hertz in the bandwidth of your instrument. That is approximately 5 to 6 orders of magnitude lower than the noise in this room. And it's maybe 7 or 8 orders of magnitude lower than the noise in a regular lab room, which is much noisier than this room. And so how do you achieve this? So you build an underground laboratory. This is in Kharkov in Konya. Here's the lab floor, and the external ground level is out here. So we demolished one floor of the building, which was at this level, and then dug down another floor to get something like the channel tunnel. To do this, they had to come in from the outside, like two miles. And then we built this termination here. This is a secret weapon. It's 1,500 tons of concrete. It's an impedance mismatch for the noise in the floor of the building. Whatever your enemies or friends do, they send some noise down to you, but it gets bounced off this berm of concrete and sent back to you. And then we built this ultra-low vibration lab. It's an underground concrete vault. And then we built a separate concrete block around 30 tons on vibration isolators. And this is an acoustic room. And then on top of this object, we built another acoustic room, an internal acoustic room. This will get you about halfway to your target. So in the internal acoustic room, we built a lead ultra-low vibration cryostat. This is made of mostly lead. It looks like wood, but it's hollow wooden shell filled with lead shot, about 4 tons. With another layer of vibration oscillation. And then inside there, we built this ultra-low vibration refrigerator. Here's the STM thing inside this apparatus. And that gets you to where you go.
At what cost?
I'm contractually prevented from answering that question. But it does get you into the realm of a gravity wave and something. It's quite good enough to make a difference in gravity wave. So here's the STM thing here. Oh, here's the achievement on board our heads right now. The two colors are with and without our refrigerators running, and here's our 30 nanog per root hertz line, and we basically achieved that. And that means we can get these data sets now, actually, in like 12 hours. So the turnaround is very good. Now, that's a little bit distressing, or it should be a little bit distressing to you, because you may have read papers in which the authors tell you that because they have atomic resolution in the topograph, you should believe that the spectroscopic information has the same quality. So atomic resolution topographic imaging requires noise in the 10 picometer range. The fluctuations you see on here are in the 10 picometer range. But good spectroscopic imaging requires in the 10 to the minus 14 meter RMS fluctuation range. So how can you demonstrate from atomic resolution that you have good spectroscopic imaging? The answer is obvious, you cannot. Doesn't really, it's kind of necessary, but not very helpful to me.
Well, Seamus, how does this vibrational noise show up in the spectrum if I took a crappy spectrum?
Oh, you could take the time sequence. You would see the white noise due to the accelerations at the level I showed you. And it would be adding in quadratures with the white shot noise from the current amplifier. that make sense?
But I'm not sure that it answers the level of my theory.
Okay, let's
understand.
Yeah.
So what would my STMs, let's say I had a nice D-wave superconductor, I took an STM image, what would be the...
You mean a topographic image?
No, spectrum.
Oh, what would a bad spectrum look like?
Yeah, would it be a noisy spectrum?
Yeah.
Would the features be washed out? Or would it
would be washed out in energy, and it would be streaky in real space, because the tip motion would be getting into the observables. And if you took it again, a second time, you get a different result, because the systematic fluctuations would be getting into the observables. Okay, so how do you do it? Well, your objective is to get atomic resolution spectroscopic images. So what you do is you check to see whether your spectroscopic imaging, so this is a differential conductance image. Now this is some high energy in VSTO. You can ignore this stuff for the moment. You go down to low energies, where what exists are the scattering resonances. There they are. Okay? Now this is a spectroscopic image. You see each scattering resonance, if you see them clearly with atomic resolution, they're not doubled, and you can determine their signal to noise, then you know the rest of the spectroscopic information is correct. And one should require something like this simultaneous with any relevant data set. It's not good enough to say I did this several years ago, and therefore my STM is okay. We require this to be simultaneous with any recordable data set. Okay. Any questions about that technology? I'm going to start talking about physics now.
If I looked at that same image atomically, I wouldn't see anything.
Absolutely nothing. Except if you turn down the bias. If you allow the bias voltage to go down to the range where this was done, this is probably plus or minus 1 millivolt. So take a topographic image where the bias voltage was 1 millivolt, then this Z would have to respond, and you would see these impurity states in the topograph.
If I happen to be at the...
Pardon?
If I happen to be at the feature, whatever...
Well, it has to be a zero bias feature if you want to find it at low bias. Thanks. Any other questions? So here's the picture that Uchida-sensei showed us from Esaki and Frederick.
One more question.
Yes, sir.
So I understand the stability, I understand various things. The thing that always bothered me, though, is matrix elements and what we really know about how this tip explores the objects that are the chemicals that are below.
So the way we've built up some confidence over the years about what the properties of those matrix elements are is by comparing the observables with the theoretical prediction, let's say for scattering resonances or for vortex cores and so on. And as you guys all know, it's not a perfect comparison. There can be an unknown matrix element in this problem. And it's very difficult for us to think of an experiment where we can get this. So the matrix element problem is a very difficult one to deal. One thing we do, Doug, is that we try to report observables. For example, energy and long distance wavelengths or wave vectors, which is difficult to imagine how they would get messed up by the matrix element. So we've always started to do that. Okay, so our collaboration for a number of years now has been trying to understand, you know, whether or not the dopant atoms are merely contributing to the superconductivity, or maybe they're a significant perturbation, or maybe in fact they're quite destructive, and TC could be twice as high. So that's the ultimate problem. So here's the phase diagram once again. I'm going to talk about work in this area, not today, but on the next occasion. Today we'll be talking approximately in this range. Now there's a number of problems you have to deal with on the theoretical side. You have to deal with the correlations of the carriers in the dopant-mach insulator. and various projection schemes have been developed to do that. I don't intend to discuss this today. I also will discuss this a little bit later. We got to deal with the other order parameters which could be hanging around, and there's a very large number of them. But something which people were very well aware of at the beginning of IPC, and then their focus moved away, and then it's moving back again. So this is this growth, here's the CO2 there. When you introduce the non-stoichiometric doping atoms, it makes this into a conductor, a superconductor. But people have always worried that each doping atom somehow does something to the local electronic environment. Certainly in a doped semiconductor, everybody knows that if you don't put in the dopants properly, you can make the property very, very cheap. So we're going to look at the situation from two points of view, the real space electronic structure and the momentum space electronic structure. And I guess probably for this audience, I don't have to try and convince you, but we do feel that both points of view are necessary to understand what's going on. Here is the Fermi, a quarter of the Fermi surface of this flow 2212. Here's the pi 0 point and the pi pi point. And along this Fermi surface in the superconducting stage, a gap with which is fourfold symmetric opens in the density of state. And also at low doping, there is something like this even above P. And this reorganizes the band structure in the superconducting phase in this fashion with these famous bananas. These are the contours upon which a state exists at a given energy. Now, by using these techniques, we find out that down here at very low energies, there are modulations in the density of states in this. These are tweed-like patterns, which are static, but rather well-ordered. Their correlation length is between 80 and 100 angstroms. Then, at higher energies, if we make these gap maps, take the distance between these two peaks and divide by two, we get these horribly disordered pictures of the electronic structure, where the gap can change by a factor of between 3 and 4 in a distance of 1 nanometer. Difficult to credit this, actually. TC of this piece of material here is around 75 kelvin. It's pretty difficult to believe. And also, the topographic images are themselves very disordered, which was one of the earliest hints that something was going on. So we have three types of disorder. We have this interference pattern. I'll show you that it's predominantly quantum particle interference. We have this superconducting energy gap disorder, and we have this topographic disorder. Okay, so the topographic disorder, based on the equation we've been discussing, you could say that the current is a constant times this WKB factor and the integral of the density of states. So if you rewrite this equation to make the topographic image, to bring it here, then you'll see that the topographic image, if this equation is correct, is related to the log of the integrated density of states, at least in a simple single particle picture. But the integrated density of states multiplied by the charge on an electron is the charge. Okay, so people have felt that this image is a logarithmic image of charge density variation. And one thing I will be attempting to do is to disabuse you of that notion. The amount of charge density variation you would deduce from these low bias images is enormous. And we don't really believe that that amount of charge density variation exists. And of course, you'd like to know, what is the microscopic trigger to produce this phenomenon? Now, the gap map disorder is basically universally seen. If you use this same sequence of techniques, you see these images of the superconducting energy gap in the Briscoe family, 2201, 2212, and 2223 having this nanoscale disorder. And zooming in a little bit, what's actually happening, now these are derived images and these are raw data. If you travel along this line, let's say in this region here you have a high gap, and the spectrum looks like that. You go into this little object, you have a smaller gap with high, sharp coherence peaks. Then you go into this region, you have this high gap, etc., etc. Essentially, universal observation, this classical phenomenon. Now, at high overdoping, which we're just beginning to assess, the absolute magnitude of the gap variation is diminishing, but the fractional magnitude is not diminishing. So the mean value of delta might be 15 millivolts, and the modulation might be 5 millivolts. But the fractional variations are still on the order of. Now, here are spectra at a sequence of different locations. And one thing you can see is that at low energies, very little spatial variation. And as I'll show you, the momentum space picture also looks quite ordered at these low energies. Whereas out here at high energies, the harsh contrast of these images is coming from these very large variations which are occurring from location to location at high energies. Now, as a function of doping, yeah.
I noticed that when you were showing today this morning, the low part of the timing curve from your sample from the other material, the other main composition, but the low bias part of your timing curve really supports pretty disorder as well, right? It doesn't go in. Well, how do you work on this right?
It's universal in 2212 from about 65 Kelvin underbuilt until around 70 Kelvin underbuilt.
What about the Kelvin material?
I don't know. Oh, you mean the oxychloric material?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, there's a low energy range below around 7 millivolts where it's like that. Sorry. Okay, so as a function of doping, you have these gap maps, and they're inhomogeneous at all dopings, but well, at least human perception does see some evolution, and there certainly is an evolution because these black regions here are regions where local limits can be detected at no doping. But what's causing all this disorder? We didn't know for a long time. And now the quasi-particle interference study. If you put impurities in the metal, they make Friedel oscillations. If you take the Fourier transform, so this is gold. If you take the Fourier transform of the local density of states of an impure metal, you'll see that it's made up of a small set of wave vectors, and their length is 2kF because of the Friedel response in the impure. Deng Hai Li proposed to have a disordered high TC superconductor and use the same information. This was now, in fact, just over 2 years ago. And his model was that the superconducting electronic structure is such that the joint density of states is very high at a given energy at the tips of these domains. So as a function, and any scattering which occurs between, let's say, this momentum state and that momentum state will produce an interference pattern whose Q vector is given by the difference vector, the elementary property of the domain. But within this model, since these high joint density of states regions are a function of energy, you would expect the pattern of these Q vectors, which is shown over here, to depend on energy in a characteristic fashion in the view of the superconductor. One can take the data to explore that. Let's say we take the density of states as a function of energy. In this sample here, you see interference patterns. You see them changing their wave vectors, the directions of their wave vectors. You go over to the empty states, you see the wave vectors are changing, the interference patterns are evolving. And you can see this much more clearly if you just look at the Fourier transform of that data set. You see that there was a small set of Q vectors in those interference patterns, and they evolved in a very simple fashion as a function of energy. And within this model, they allow us to find where the scattering was coming from, and also to estimate what the gap in the density of states is. Presumably, the superconducting gap in the optimal state. And the last focal mission, we can do this for the unoccupied states as well as the occupied states. And the gap, to the extent that we can determine it, has the same B-wave structure for the empty states as the filled states. That would be Bob-Lubov signature. Now, recently, in order to test this set of ideas, Bob Markowitz proposed that the autocorrelation of AK of omega from photo emission be made with the Fourier transform of the STS step. And that's because the perturbation to the density of states in Q space can be calculated from the photo emission spectral function by taking an autocorrelation. So you measure AK of omega, and then you take this AK of omega data and calculate the outer correlation of it. It looks something like this. And then you want to compare that outer correlation with the Fourier transform SPS data at the same energy. And this was reported more or less simultaneously by Kaminsky and Campuzano's group, and also Kyle McElroy and Lenzel. And so here is auto correlation of photo emission data, and here's Fourier transform SPS. And as a function of energies, they actually do undergo rather remarkably similar trajectories. All that this shows is essentially that the states accessed by tunneling are the same as the states accessed by photo emission. But I don't think that's too trivial. The matrix elements are very different. Shows that you're dealing with the same thing.
Yeah. So the fact is, so there's a shadow line is going to do, that mean anything?
I don't know. I can find out the answer. I guess photo emission, this may be the magnitude of the energy. I don't know if they have compared field states with both field and open field, but I can find out. Okay. But again, what's causing all this scattering? So the picture here is that there's a lot of quantum particle interference going on, but what is causing it? So one very interesting calculation by Bill and Peter was to take two populations, one of unitary scatterers and another of Born scatterers, and somehow balance them out and find in Wagner-Love Degen picture what the modulations in the density of states would look like and how they compare with the experiment.
It's interesting, the numbers did come out to be quite low.
They gave the ratio of the numbers of weak scatterers to strong scatterers in the paper. If we identify these open atoms with the weak scatterers, the numbers turn out to be low. Okay, so one model for what could be causing this disorder is the one I showed you. You put the dopant atoms in the top layer. They're oxygen minus 2e charge, and they somehow are insufficiently screened, and they accumulate. Because they're negatively charged, they accumulate holes nearby. That would make these little droplets of higher hole density. That's one classic model. So wherever the dopant is, there would be a higher hole density, and at least in theory, a lower gap magnitude. Another one is a model of, in the Abrakasov-Gorkov ilk, that there is a lot of scattering going on. You imagine that there's a population of scatterers, but they're primarily producing weak and somewhat forward scattering. And they do produce an inhomogeneous picture of the electronic structure, but the variations in the gap magnitude are not really large. And another one that Al Bishop has been discussing for a long time is that when you put the dopant atoms, you actually stress the crystal on the nanoscale. And that does, and there's no microscopic model in these papers. The stress may be there, but what it actually does to the electronic structure remains to be seen. Okay. Now, when you put the dopant atoms in visco, it's an amazing fact that after almost 20 years, it's not known where the dopant atoms are in these materials. Not from X-ray scattering, not from neutron scattering, and probably not from SCN studies. It's very difficult to find where these objects are. It's always believed that they're somewhere near the bismuth oxide layer. That's been the standard rule. How to find them by SCN? We saw a beautiful talk from Hide Tagaki this morning about how to find, yeah.
What's the standard lore based on? Anything?
Physical chemistry, I guess, for the lowest energy sites which could exist in the crystal. For example, between the bismuth oxide, there is the Van der Waals bond, and there's another place. I agree. I completely agree. Maybe Uchida sensei can comment.
Yeah, because the bismuth oxygen layer is positively charged. Because the bismuth balance of sleeper, so that it's positively charged. So that oxygen 2 minus dies to be in the bismuth oxygen layer. Otherwise, strontium oxide layer is neutral, because strontium 2 plus, and the copper oxygen layer is minus, negatively charged. So the best way for the excess oxygen is bismuth oxygen plane.
Tataki-sensei showed us how to find, if you substitute in these crystals, an impurity state due to having the wrong atom at the wrong location. The state will appear somewhere near the Fermi energy. Now, it might be within 5 volts of the Fermi energy, or it might be within 0.5 volts, but the state should appear. And secondly, these, the dopant atoms, are supposed to be negatively charged. By convention, that means that there are additional electrons that peak in the density of states of that impurity state should be below the Fermi energy. And that's essentially the information we have available to search for these guys by STM. So we're searching for an electronic impurity state with the same population as the non-stoichiometric oxygen atoms, which are fully produced. So here's a typical high voltage spectrum. Well, this is an interesting point. I forgot to say this in the technology. It's rare to see high voltage spectra of cupules. And the reason is that if the tip is, let's say, 3 angstroms from the surface, and you apply 1 volt, that's 3 × 10⁹ volts per meter as the electric field. And that's bigger than the rupture field of many of these materials. So when you turn on the bias, it just rips off the top surface of the tip. Now, the way to avoid that is to have the tip be 12 angstroms away. Then the field is low, and you can do the experiment. Okay, the problem is that the signal to noise is too low to do for that to be used. But in these ultra-low vibration facilities, that's not true. We can work back very far away, junction resistances of more than 100 gigohms, and still get atomic resolution spectroscopic information. So now we start to get high voltage information. The top edge of the lower band that Bill was asking about is here. The bottom edge of the upper band is just over. Here's the superconductivity in the 50 millivolt range, and here is what in a conventional material would be the density of state of the atmosphere. Now, 99 point something percent of the surface has a spectrum that looks like this, but a fraction in the 1% range has a spectrum that looks like this. There's a big peak here in the minus 1. It's actually minus 960. This is like the 700 millivolt peak that we saw this morning in Kakaki Sensei's class. So we image the density of states now at this energy, minus 0.96 volts, and we see this image. I can assure you we were very happy to see this image. There's a sequence of atomic scale objects. Each one of these objects has a peak in the density of states at minus 960. They are not Poisson random because they have an exclusion zone. So the probability of finding two of them too close together is small. But aside from that exclusion zone, they are random. They're not ordered in space. So the autocorrelation has a dip near zero, and then nothing. I have to look up the numbers, but it's in the 10 angstrom range. And we can do this at different locales. In STM, the identity of the atoms you have in there, they don't come with their names tattooed on their forehead. You can't be certain that a given object is the element that you think it is. So the standard technique to find out, let's say, if this is produced by an oxygen atom, is to change the population of oxygen atoms in CY. And we can do that. So at low doping, by virtue of the work of Uchida Sensei and colleagues, we have the privilege of doing this. At low dopings, so this is a almost 500 angstrom field of view, every place where we see one of these objects, we put a white dot on top of the simultaneously acquired delta. And the number of objects here was 455. The number here was 580. This is at higher doping, the number was 580. And at higher doping, the number is 830. So the number of these objects is growing steadily as the ostensible population of dopant atoms is growing. Now, you might want to know how many holes per duct. I mean, the proposal is that each dopant atom puts 2 holes into the plate. So tell me how many holes per duct. So to do that, this was the best argument we could come up with. From our studies, the average value of the gap is changing with the number density of these objects, the number per plaquette of these objects, according to this equation. So as the number of these objects is increasing, the gap is decreasing. Sorry, I don't have the color scale here, but this is low gap and this is high gap. On the other hand, break junction tunneling of the same materials shows, and this is the argon group, shows that the average gap follows this equation, where this is the hole density that they deduce from their fabrication technique. So this is the gap as a function of the number of R960 impurity states, and this is the average gap as a function of the number of holes. And if you divide one equation by the other, you will conclude that each of those dots is associated with close to two holes. Okay. So we have these atomic scale objects. They have a peak at minus 960. At least the bias sign is correct for a negatively charged overcap. They occur on the line bismuth oxygen bismuth line, and that line is at 45 degrees to the copper oxygen copper line below. Top surface is a different crystal structure than the CO2. But they don't occur at an atomic site. They occur somehow at an interstitial site, and we don't know in the z-axis where they are on the crystal. And the resolution of this designation isn't very high. Look at that topograph. There's a lot of disorder in the topograph because of the supermodule. It's really difficult to be certain where an object is. But the number of these objects scales appropriately with the dopant density of the material. So it's reasonable to propose that these are impurity states produced by the dopant atoms. If that is true, this is the first case where we've been able to see the dopant atoms and the electronic structure at the same time.
But the length scale issue, this nanoscale, the length scale was about 3 to 4 nanometers.
Yes.
And option case, you don't really have this number.
Well, I'll show you the correlations from all these data sets. And you'll see that the length scales are in rather
Are you
going to
say?
Maybe I can simplify a little bit the answer to that question. The diameter of the domains is about 3 nanometers, but the radius is about 15 angstroms. The mean distance between these objects is about 15 angstroms.
Are you going to say anything about whether you expect to find a resonance of that energy?
I can say that I don't. The only thing I know is what I've learned from my colleagues, which is a rule of thumb that in these materials you can think of which bias sign to search for the impurity state. But if you mean a real calculation of the solid state physics of this object, I know of no such calculation. Yes, sir.
So there is no correlation in this oxygen data from all the potential. This is oxygen and pi-ray supercluster. Because all the chemicals have a lot, but this pi-ray supercluster you may be with
this is oxygen. There is, if there is any correlation, it's very weak. Alright. So there's the population of proposed causes for the disorder. Now, I want to say something. Even if we misidentify these objects, and they are not, in themselves, an oxygen atom, what I'm going to show you now is that they are the source of the electronic disorder. So subsequent identification as a different object does not change the main deduction. There's a population of atomic scale objects which are causing the electronic disorder. So here's an image at minus 960. See an object like this, or like that? That's where there's the radius of these states is about 4 angstroms. Here there are two relatively nearby, so they're overlapping in this complex. So these are the typical objects. You can write down the coordinates of every object, at least Kyle McElroy can write down the coordinates of every object. And then you can check that you chose the coordinates correctly, and the error is very small for knowing where each of these objects are. Now here's a topograph. This was historically the driver of the search for this disorder, the topographic disorder. And you can lay the locations of the dopant atoms on that picture and ask yourself whether you think they are the cause of that topographic disorder. It's pretty hard to tell, actually. Doesn't really look deterministic. Here's a gap map. There's a simultaneous gap map in that sample. Atomic resolution gap map. Simultaneous with this image of where the disorder is. Now you can name the locations on that image and ask yourself whether there's a correlation between the colored image of the gap magnitude and the locations of where these impurity stays out. And it takes most people about 10 or 12 seconds to see that there is a very strong correlation. And the correlation is that these low-gap regions, where you have high sharp coherence, are almost never associated with clusters of these putative Doppler patterns, or the converse. The putative Doppler patterns, wherever they're clustered, they give you this low-gap, pseudo, perhaps pseudo-gap-like spectrum. Yes, sir?
But it doesn't seem to be, I mean, I agree that these red dots sit on black regions, but you don't need to have a red dot to have a black region.
Quite correct. So one thing to consider is that there's another population of Doppler patterns underneath the bilayer, and we don't know where they are. And we don't
they would be much farther from the top.
Well, they wouldn't be much farther from the lower bilayer, so it depends on how the two parts of the bilayer are in communication. Or another possibility is that there's other populations of impurity, bismuth strontium intersubstitutions, or some other chemical impurity. It seems reasonable that another atomic scale impurity might also do some of these same things.
James, I wasn't sure about the fire.
You're the chairman.
Well, shall we plan to finish at 4?
Okay. Now, mathematically,
we have the one and two, because I'm not sure what that is.
But there's another talk.
But there's another talk.
So you want to do this mathematically. You have an image, let's say, of the gap disorder, and a different image of where these impurity states are. You want to take a normalized correlation function between these two images, and you do that by dividing by the terms of the product of the autotrophs. I apologize if this is too explicit for theorists. For experimentalists, we'd like to know what this will produce a function which at zero displacement between the two images is plus one if they're identical. It's minus one if one is the inverse or negative of the other. And it's zero if there's no local problem. Well, now I want to show you raw data. Each one of these little red circles is the location of one of those minus 960 states. And this is the energy in which we're imaging the density of states. So, for example, you can see that in this experiment, we did achieve our design objective to see a small population of atomic resonances, telling us that we have atomic resolution and our tip is not double the strength in the SL. Now, at low energies, there's very little correlation between the location of. No, they're vacancy. It's about 1 in 20,000. There's almost no correlation between the Doppler patterns and the local density of states.
Okay. Yeah. A typical fraction, 1 in 20,000.
Yeah. That's how we can always test that tips are okay, because all the I wish we had the equivalent. Okay, there's a little correlation between the Doppler patterns and the electronic structure here because the density of states at the Fermi point is basically zero. There are no states to correlate. So let's go up in energies now and see what happens. 10 millivolts. Now, if you look carefully, there's a little correlation now. Many of the black regions, the low density of states regions, have a high probability to see an oxygen atom. Let's keep going up in energy. 20 millivolts. Now the correlation is the human eye will find it. Kyle McElroy and I found it independently in the raw data with no tools at this level. The probability that one of the Doppler patterns will be in one of these dark regions is enormously higher than it would be at now. I'll show you the calculation in a second. Let's keep going up in energy now. At this energy, you have the clearest correlation. You have a lot of interference patterns. Their contrast is high. Their correlation length is short. And amazingly, somehow, they arrange themselves so that at the minimum of the density of states modulation, the minimum occurs preferentially near one of these impurity states. Let's go up to the energy of superconductivity now, the gap energy. Here's the gap energy. these white regions are high sharp coherent peak regions, and they almost never have a Doppler damage associated with them. Oh, they do have associated, the Doppler damage are on the perimeter of these objects. So here's the correlation between the local density of states image and the image of the putative Doppler damage as a function of energy for the filled, for the empty and filled states. Here you see the correlation is low and then it rises rapidly and it stays high for a wide energy. This correlation number, minus 0.3, might strike you as small, but it's actually rather high for correlating an image that has effectively two different areas. One image is just a sequence of dots. The other image is a homogeneous image. This is a high correlation number between two such things.
So negative means what? Negative means
it means the minimum of the density of states is preferentially at the location of the empirical states. Now let's start to the charge distribution. Previously, I said that we were constrained to do experiments at low bias, typically below 100-150 millivolts. So these are Fourier filtered topographic images of the type from which it was originally deduced that there is strong charge disorder in DISCO. And they're at plus minus 100 millivolts.
Can you say that again?
So this is a 500 angstrom square image, topographic image, which if I showed you the raw image, you'd see all the atomic locations and you'd see the supermodulation. You Fourier filter those things away and you just leave behind the long-range disorder. Okay? And I'm going to keep constant contrast. So these are all simultaneous experiments. So this is 100 millivolts, 300 millivolts, 600 millivolts, 900 millivolts. Here the tip ripped the top off the crystal, so we don't have this data set. But what you can see is that the apparent topographic contrast decays away as you go to high bias. And this is a logarithmic image of the putative charge disorder. The logarithmic change from here to here is huge. Here you might have thought the charge density variations were a factor of 2. Here they're well below 10%. Which is much closer to what the NMR colleagues said the charge density variations have to be. So we do not think there are giant charge density variations. We think we were constrained to a low voltage.
Making you draw on the first low voltage one, a picture of where the oxygen is.
I can do that.
Would we see a correlation?
Yes, you would. I'll show you the numbers showing that that's true.
Yeah, so what's your point? That you were saying that you have found where the dopant atoms are, but now you're saying that it's not causing a density variation?
That's the point.
The point is first.
How are you making that statement? I didn't understand that because here you are seeing a density
variation. No, you're not. The deduction, let's do it mathematically. You recall that I showed you that the topograph is a function of the bias voltage, and it's related to the log of the integral density of states. So the topograph at a given voltage tells you about how the variation of the sum over the density of states, namely all the states, is varied. Now, if you do this at low bias, you find that there are big variations. That's what these images show. Okay, but if you sum up over all the states in that band, and the edge of that band is near 1 volt, so that you put this number up here near 1 volt, then you find out that, in fact, within the whole band, there's no real evidence for powerful charge density variations. What there's evidence for is that there are spectral wave shifts from low to high energy nearby the Doppler patterns. And that's supposed to be the last few minutes of this talk. So here's your typical low bias image. You look at this image, you think you have a whole bunch of disorder. But in fact, if you integrate over the whole band, there's not a lot of evidence for charge disorder. Or the charge disorder which is there is below 10% of the field state. Okay, here's the cross correlations. So we take the correlation between an image of the impurity atoms and an image of the gap. That would be this one here. And they have a strong positive correlation. Wherever there are a lot of impurity atoms, the gap is high. We take a correlation between the, dopant atoms and the topograph, and there's a modest negative correlation. And we take the correlation between the high voltage topograph and where the dopant atoms are, and there's essentially no correlation, and that's because there's no charge disorder. And this class of curves, as far as we can, the range of dopings we've studied, looks the same. Now, the hypothesis has to be that to get this structure, you have to have a spectral weight shift. So then we did a high voltage spectroscopic map of this, our other field of view. And then we color coded the average spectrum associated with each region. Let's say these yellow guys go with those yellow guys, these blue guys go with those guys, and so on. To the degree that the dopant atoms are correlated with the gap map, and this represents how the gap map is changing from regions of good superconductivity to regions of bad superconductivity. What you see is that spectral, in a good superconducting region, the spectral weight is down here at low energies. And in a bad, or, well, in a different superconducting region, the spectral weight has shifted up here. But when we integrate up to just below 900 millivolts, the spectral weight is conserved. The main thing that these atoms do is not to produce charge density variation. It's the shift, the spectral rate from low to high energy nearby. It's a strong correlation, or perhaps crystal distortion. Question?
So, but how are you adjusting the tip height? You used to do it by making the tunneling current the same at a high bias voltage. But
right.
Now
so,
you're arguing that the integral is the same. Isn't that circular?
No, it's not. Because we, if the topograph has no disorder a priori, there's no logical reason to renormalize the spectrum. So it's not circular. It uses a piece of the same logic, but it's not circular. I'll write it down for you.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So if you integrate all the electrons, then you have two electron volts k.
Yeah.
Right. You count the number of electrons like here, almost one electron per kappa.
Yeah.
And if this is the case, you know, it may not be surprising, you know, the charge distribution is so homogeneous because of high energy. Right. But then what you're talking about, you know, carrier density, so the low energy spectrum rate.
Okay, so that's a very interesting question. Who's distinguishing between localized and delocalized states?
Yes.
And it could be that these states are delocalized carriers, and these states here are localized. And so then you might say the charge density associated with the transport process is inhomogeneous. You're absolutely right. But we don't have an observable that tells us, you know, this state is localized and this state is delocalized. That remains to be determined. But I completely agree. It could be a shift from delocalized to localized near these objects.
Even in optical, if you integrate all the optical on the spectral wave up to the electron, you get more of a constant, right? But the transport is becoming only low energy spectral wave.
So I completely agree with you, Vidé. But from the point of view of Coulomb scattering producing the disorder in the delocalized states, there's not a lot of evidence for Coulomb potentials, for big Coulomb potentials varying from location to location. Another question? Yeah.
No, it's just some clarification. I think this maybe shows it. So when you plot these gap maps and you show these black regions and we think of them as 60 MeV or something like that, but over here on that curve, the lowest graph, what is, it's hard to see what is the gap really.
Well, the one where we could find a gap is this blue one, 65. 65 is the highest energy where we ever find a gap.
Okay, and then all those regions we should basically think of as...
They don't have any coherence peaks at all.
At all, yeah.
Okay, some summaries. Can you find impurity atoms? Yes, at least if these states are impurity atoms. Are they associated with the interference? Yes, the correlation is very high with the interference patterns. Are they the source of the disorder? Well, they're the source of some of it. Probably a big fraction. It's difficult to prove that they're the source of all the disorder. And I don't think there are large charge density variations. Do they suppress the superconductivity? It looks like they do. This is a map of the coherence peaks. The regions where there are high, sharp coherence peaks, the probability that there will be a cluster of these atoms there is basically zero. that some evidence that somehow they damage the coherent superconductivity. They do it by shifting spectral weight, but at the atomic scale, we don't know why. And some people argue that this points to ITC as being a local phenomenon. Now, the authors of this paper are in the audience. They have very recently proposed, Peter Hirschfeld's group, that these objects modulate the pair interactions at the atomic scale. They use a relatively well-known simple Hamiltonian, but they apply both potential disorder, somewhat screened potential disorder, and a perturbation to the pair potential nearby each token pair. In these calculations, they get these variations of coherence peak height with delta as is seen in the data. But in order to do so, they primarily are dealing with tau 1 scattering. Not Coulomb scattering, not magnetic scattering, but pair potential variation scattering. The correlations, for example, between the dopants and the gap are of the correct sign and of the other observables. And I didn't have time to summarize much more of that proposal, except to say that it appears to capture almost all the available facts. On behalf of my colleagues, thank you very much.
Okay, it's time for a couple of questions.
What about the bismuth oxide layer? I mean, the early LDA calculations suggested that, in fact, there should be a piece of Fermi surface. And then later ones show that the bismuth oxide band, I think, is slightly above the Fermi level. You guys are getting to large enough bias voltages now that you might have a chance to see it. I don't know. Do you know why haven't you seen it? Is it just too high an energy or not enough spectral weight? Or?
Let's see. We do see the bottom of an upper band over here, actually near almost up to 2 volts. We don't know if that's the bottom of Hubbard band, if it's the edge of the bismuth oxide band, we don't know the answer to that question. So to identify some spectral feature here, we have to change it by doing something to the crystal. But we do see bands over there on the right hand side, above the Fermi energy.
Do we have an understanding for the proposed oxygen position you find? Because from Professor Scheele was that you can guess that it should be in bismuth oxygen layer, mm-hmm. right? From an electrostatic argument. Mm-hmm. It sounded very simple. And could we understand it from the crystallographic structure? Why should it be there, displaced along bismuth oxygen?
Well, there is a site on the top surface at that location.
Could you show the crystal structure that I can try to understand why? Scheele
sensei showed it this morning, I guess in the top layer, if you draw the bismuth oxygen line,
yeah.
So the typical location where we find this object is approximately here, on the line between the bismuth atoms, but through the location of the stoichiometric oxygen. I guess you would argue that if it was sitting on the top surface, it should be closer to one of these objects, yeah. And maybe at that
point. Yeah, so that would be a naive guess somehow.
Yeah.
Unless it's important what the C-axis coordinate truly is of this object, right?
Well, the SDM doesn't have the capability to tell you from how far
down. No, that was not a question. That's the comment from myself, yeah. Right? The initial understanding of why it should be there is not easy,
I would say.
You can only imagine there must be a reason what's happening underneath. So. May I ask a second question? Bill asked or made the observation that you have some black spot above regions without any interstitial spot there. So telling that the white gap region with no coherence peak is not necessarily always connected to one of the interstitials you find. So you said most likely it can happen from something underneath. That might be telling there is crosstalk between the layers, and how could that actually happen? I don't quite understand how this information could be transferred from one layer to the other one. Somehow crosstalk should be there, but I don't quite understand the mechanism.
I don't understand either. And of course, think about the trajectory of doping. When you extract all of the non-stoichiometric oxygen atoms from these materials, you end up with all of this black stuff. So there is some.
That's
it's as if there is. If you wanted to rationalize it, you'd have to say there's a global and a local effect of the dopant atoms, and the two effects are opposite.
So I would like to also, you showed us one of the spectra where the tip is poised right above one of the oxygens, or putative oxygens. Can you comment on what the variability of that spectrum is? If you put the tip on many, many, many dots, do you see really always the same thing? Or
they're not at precisely the same energy. They're jiggling back and forth a little bit, but they're always broad. And they're always in that range, 960 plus or minus. 196 plus or minus
0.15. So I also have a question about the amount of spectral transfer, the positive and the negative ones.
Yeah.
So can you come to other, I understand the state, say oxygen, assigned oxygen state with minus 0.9, somewhere out there. There's quite a bit of spectral wave transfer and negative bias, still yet he's saying that there is positive bias spectral wave transfer here. And how much do you have any, can you quantify how different
are,
they
are? Are you saying
yes.
the
red to blue?
How this amount here compares to this amount here?
Well, you said actually they should
they're
be
the same. Okay, so how this amount compares to this amount?
Right. Yeah. The negative.
So on the negative side, there's much more variation.
The amount of the spectral transfer on the negative side is much larger than the positive side. Yet, if I go to one electron volt, in the integral issue, I have to have essentially homogeneous. So basically, there's a lot of spectral wave happening, transfer happening on the negative bias,
yeah.
Point to point.
Yeah.
Yet still there is some on the positive side as well.
Well, if you're implying that in order to balance the spectral wave, let's say under this
right.
Red curve, by the spectral wave under this black curve, it's yeah. A function of something that happens over here. That's not correct. That balance just has to do with integrating under this curve. Here and under this curve here and taking the difference between them and then doing the same thing out here. It's not related to the empty state.
But the cross correlation on the positive and on the
yeah.
That something is going on.
Yes,
the
I agree
as well.
No, I agree. What you can see here is that somehow the gap is opening, the coherence peaks are going down
right.
Nearby these optics on both sides. So that points to a strong correlation.
Right. The coherence peaks that you have that are in red there,
yeah.
We know seem stronger than you could ever get from a BCSD wave.
Correct.
And somehow one of the pictures of those is they come out of a patch where maybe the gap somehow is smaller and they occur as resonances. And then maybe as you move to where it's green and blue, you're into a region where for some reason, because of your oxygens, you've got a stronger pairing. That's the picture of it.
Yeah.
You're telling us that. And yet, this morning, that's got to come along with a picture that says the gap interaction may be bigger, but it's a worse superconductor.
Yeah, the gap is big when it's 75 millivolts at low doping, but TC is zero. So that's the same mystery that we've been dealing with for a long time.
Right.
But this is the atomic scale version.
Mm-hmm. But that mystery would be one that would say as you underdope this, you would have more and more of that pseudo gap
yeah.
Like state.
Yeah.
And that doesn't seem to jive so well with the O double minus correlated.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unless some of the holes near the oxygen are pulled down to lower energies, so that near the Fermi level, you've got fewer mobile holes near the oxygen.
So down here is the low doping.
But that's what the spectral wave transfer essentially is telling you, right? You're digging in the hole and then you're seeing the
low doping. Well, here's the low doping limit. And indeed, there's much more of this no coherence peak stuff. And there's much less of this good superconducting stuff. And the absolute magnitude of the correlations is diminishing a little bit on that side, but they're still there. So I don't know what the zero doping. There has something else has to happen before zero doping. Or another possibility is that although these objects are strongly correlated with the disorder, they are not the oxygen atoms. That's still a logical possibility.
You will get more. Okay, thank you, Seamus.